Hi guys, I just wanted to thank one more time Jason so much for coming, and just wanted to let you know that if you are in the midst of finals or feel like your stress levels are really high, this is definitely a must listen. Enjoy, y'all.
Hi guys, welcome back to What's On Your Mind. I'm here today with Jason Field. Jason is a podcast host and a soon-to-be author with an audience amassing nearly 550,000 people across his social platforms. After being burnt out three times at 25, 28, and 31, Jason speaks a ton about mental health across his platforms. And today, he is here not only to share his story, but also share learnings, insights, and tips on how we can improve our mental health and stay in a good rhythm once we get there. Jason, thank you so much for being here. Why don't you say hi?
Thank you for having me. What an intro. You've done your research. I'm impressed.
Thank you. Okay, so before we get started, why don't you give us a little rundown of who you are and what you do in your own words?
Sure. So I'm trying to develop a platform that concentrates on mental health with a emphasis on going back, working out where we went wrong in order to show up now, because I think there's a lot of baggage in the past that we try to say, it's not worthy. It's something that I can just avoid. If I want that, I'm going to keep heading in that direction. But from my experience, and as you revealed there, I kept burning out because I was in these cycles. And those cycles were triggered by these unclosed events in the past. And since entering therapy, and now I've done over 150 therapy sessions, specifically with the tradition of somatic therapy, which is quite new and not that available to as many people as I wish it was. It has really opened my eyes to how distorted our vision does get of the present, that we can't see actually what's in front of us because these biases of the past come in. They're seeking closure. And I can give examples of that as we work through, but I was really astounded to see how much I was reacting from fear and desire for closure, even when I'm looking forward and in different countries and doing different activities, but it's just little fractals on repeat. And so my mission is to get that voice out there of emotional validation, of closing these emotional energetic loops and concentrating on people that sit within my niche. And I am now trying to really deep dive into that, where I started off the conversation, and I hope you don't mind that I hold the mic for a moment just in terms of clarifying that.
Go ahead.
I started the conversation very early on in building up the audience around introverts. And then I started saying, okay, highly sensitive people as well, come into the conversation. And then I was like, hang on a second, we're all here. There's the same kettle of fish. I then wanted to back that up with science. I've done quite a bit of research on that. This is where the book will sort of have its genesis. But introverts, highly sensitive people, ADHD, autism, these sort of places are from the same reactivity, let me use the word spectrum.
Interesting.
And we are forced to show up in a way that is not authentic. And there is a lot of mental health side effects that come from that. And that swings back to my original discussion there, where you're not having an authentic version of yourself, and pretty much your only destination is burnout.
Interesting. I've never heard it be framed in that sort of manner. I think it's a lot of,
The science is changing, thankfully. This is the crazy part, because I was mute as a kid and I had extreme difficulties with socializing. I had so many symptoms that were tried to be quelled with things that didn't work. It was the opposite. Thankfully, I wasn't medicated, but I know that a lot of kids are now, and there's these incentives in schools such as you'll get more funding if you have more autistic kids that are medicated, all this type of thing. So it's within the incentive structure of a teacher to say, go and get diagnosed, and we're going to then dope you up. But it's been really interesting to see the science come more recently, specifically the work of Henry Markram, who is a neuroscientist, and I can share some of the work that he's done, who has an autistic son. And he then went on that path of, I need to find out why this is all not working and why the literature so far hasn't found a solution that in the areas that we're looking. And They're now understanding and proving it's the reactivity. It is hyper reactivity, it's hyper activation within the nervous system. And what does that mean? You are on flight, flight, or freeze response your whole goddamn life. Which, hello, introverts, it's the same thing. It's dopamine sensitivity. You walk into a room, you're overwhelmed. Why do I need to go home at 10:30? Because
Oh.
I'm spent. So this type of discussion there is something that is not up. And the methods in which I want to talk about, like
Yeah.
finding functionality again and finding your authenticity, are definitely hot at the moment, such as Gabor Mate and Peter Levine on Bessel van der Kolk and The Body Keeps the Score and that type of thing. But the seed of where my unique story is and where I think a lot of people are feeling lost, and I've found a lot of conversations, is there's a massive market gap, in my opinion. And I'd like to be the one waving that flag.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting also to think about how a lot of people's quirks and how a lot of people's like, oh, I'm just tired. I just kind of need to clock out at 10:30. Are you really just tired, or is there something more there?
Yeah, this is the trap door of trauma.
Yeah.
I was operating, and I you get to I'm not going to ask your age. My mother always told me never ask a woman her age. I'm 34. I got to 25 running on
Yeah.
hypervigilance until the body said no. It
No.
was that's it, you're done. I then, through sickness, recharged and pursued the same activities in a different way. Well, I engage with my activities in the same way, just different activities. Then I burnt out at 28. Oh, why did this happen? Then I burnt out at 31. And I'm so very happy to sit here today at 34 and say at that 3-year cycle, it stopped. I now have this really positive relationship with the world and myself, and I'm able to self-direct calm and understand where I am being triggered. But if I'd never done the therapy work, for
Yeah.
sure, I'd be burnt out again and be saying, why is this happening? What's going on? But it's all those little drivers. And we say to ourselves, like you say, oh my gosh, I'm tired. What's going on? Oh, it's just because it's a demanding world. Your nervous system is taking up 80% of the energy because it's seeking desperately this closure from, and it doesn't necessarily need to be trauma. I did have PTSD in my story, but complex trauma of just having hypervigilance on your whole life is enough to give you PTSD-like
Wow.
symptoms. And that's what's now coming out in the literature as well, which is okay, there you go. There's the validation. The person has the same response as somebody that's gone to war because they've never
Wow.
been able to officially turn off. It's mental, absolutely mental.
Wow. Wow.
The necessity is there.
That's crazy. I want to touch a little bit more on your past trauma if you're okay with it, but before we do, how can we observe that hypervigilance and hyperactivity within ourselves? Are there ways that we can notice it? Are there patterns? Are there behaviors for people who may not necessarily be in therapy, or even for those who are?
Sure. I think two things that for me are very interesting is if you've never touched calm before, then you don't know what that awareness is like. And for me, I thought yoga was for people that wanted to quit society. I thought meditation was just for loonies sitting on top of a mountain. I surfed all my life, and there's a relationship with surfing that you can find a lot of calm. But even in activities like that, I would carry myself out with this hypervigilance and never just sit. And I think that that is a crucial part of proving to yourself that there is another lens of the world that you can see through. So you've got to touch it. That's what I talk about. Touch that calm and see what that feels like and understand what sort of impulses come up there. But that can be also very overwhelming because it's the first time that the nervous system has ever experienced calm, that it can run for that gap and then you get sick. You finally slow down, just like how we know we have those stretches, 3 months really, really busy. And after we've finally finished whatever project it is, we get sick. And we go, why is that happening? Why didn't I get sick when I was super busy? The nervous system found a gap. It just kept you going with the cortisol and the adrenaline. And it's a very similar thing when you finally start talking about calm, but also then you've got to have an honest discussion with yourself on what sort of coping mechanisms are coming in. And they can be on a variety of different spectrums as well. because it can be a coping mechanism. For example, for mine was alcohol growing up. I'd seen that in my family as an appropriate way of numbing myself. Okay, there it goes. From 14 and a half years old, it was down the bottle.
Wow.
Finally, the brain turns off, you know? And now I can catch myself. I have a very positive relationship with alcohol now. I love my craft breweries and all those kind of things, but it's two beers and done rather than 14 beers and trying to make myself black out so I didn't have to feel anymore. But I can feel when I start getting overstimulated and you feel the world just sort of growing within the container of your being, where I think, oh, geez, it'd be really nice to have a beer. And I have to ask myself in that position, why am I going to that old coping mechanism? If it's having a beer with friends, socializing, that's a completely different thing. But if I'm by myself after being super stressed throughout the day and then I'm seeking the beer, that's not social. That's trying to suppress. There's a very big difference there. And I think that those questions that you ask yourself, it doesn't necessarily need to be blackout drunk to be trying to numb something.
How or what kinds of questions should we be asking ourselves? Like, is it a lot of why? Is it a lot of what does that look like? What does that self introspection look like?
That's a good question, really good question. I have been surprised throughout my therapy experience how the breakthroughs happen, them being so spontaneous, having a general conversation. Naturally, it is mental health oriented, but that I can go, oh, that was it. And then do, 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 everything just makes sense. So I definitely do work on a timeline basis. So I try and go back into a specific period and I have several periods of dissociation where I don't have great memory. It's very hazy. And if I talk about it, it feels like it's someone else's experience. Often I'm narrating from what I've heard from other people, where it's just my nervous system's clocked out. It was too much for me. So then I'm just walking around as a body and the brain hasn't really latched on. Thankfully, I've integrated a few of those experiences, but it has been on this timeline basis where I give myself a target. I say, okay, these years, very hazy. Let's try and dig in there, have a few conversations. And especially when there are moments where, and my therapist pulls me up on this, I'll say something and he goes, that sounds intense. And I have to reflect and go, oh, hang on a second. Yeah, that's actually huge. But because the moment was so big, not only does the nervous system clock out, your narration clocks out. And so you'll say something that is not very comfortable as if it's going to the shops. And he goes, Jace, mate, stop. Let's talk about that one. I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, if you want to. And then 20 minutes later, I'm in tears, you know, opening up that door. No, it's necessary. That's so important to be able to have that emotional response that's been locked up because that's where all your energy is going. All those suppressed emotions to keep that lid on. So I think it's important to create that timeline. And I guess the last thing that I'll say is have a positive association with that timeline. So I call it rewriting the hero story. So going back, you are the hero in your story. Find out the hurdles you had to overcome. So it's a story of empowerment, not a story of why me? Why did this happen? It's you came through that. You're still breathing here today, you know? Power to you. I think that's a really important element of it.
I also think there's a sense of victimhood that a lot of people
Yeah.
place on themselves. Why me? Why did this happen to me? Why now? Why? This is so tragic. But I don't know. A lot of these things, like, it happened. And what can we do about it? How can we make it better? How can we move on from it? You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a sense of like, let's sulk in this. It could be a sense of, okay, how do we move, not move on, move forward, but move past for now, right?
Definitely. Yeah. I think that it's in when we talk about PTSD and complex trauma, one of the interesting things that you come across if you deep dive into that area is the same event can happen to two different people and one person gets traumatized from it and the other person doesn't. Why is that? It's because that individual person, they have the capacity and the skill set, and also, very, very importantly, their social support network has the skill set and the capacity to take them through that. And then it's not traumatic. It's a big event. They may not wish for it to happen again, but they don't have PTSD. Whereas, and this is why I start opening up the reactivity area of things, where it's more likely to happen. If that emotional response is seen as excessive within the family unit, then suppression is more likely to happen because they say, stop that. That, according to my world, is too much. And the kid cannot sacrifice their connection. So they sacrifice their personal experience and pop, the lid goes on, and then off you go. No, it's really important
Interesting.
to flag that you're not, that life happens to everyone. It is, and the more things that happen, then you tend to be more well equipped to deal with the world and have a great story to tell. But that social support and upskilling yourself is an essential part to make sure that then, yeah, you don't have that rinse repeat that I did several years in a row.
There's also, I think, something to be said about what you were saying on how PTSD can it there could be this the same event could happen to several people and it could affect some people in a certain way and not affect others at not at all, but it's much easier for them to move like just move past it, right? Or not it not affect their everyday lives, right?
Definitely.
In that vein, how and when do we know when we're suffering from trauma or PTSD? Because I think a lot of times it's a word, it's a thing that's it's a concept that's thrown around, both of those things. And it's actually like we don't actually take a second to consider what is it? What does it entail?
Sure. So I can give you a brief rundown, especially in terms of timelines in which I was able to discover that and
Course.
overcome that, and just jump in whenever you want if it seems like I'm going off on a tangent.
Yeah, go for
You
it.
happy for it? I mentioned I was mute as a kid. Selective mutism, it wasn't always the case, and that's what was confusing as well. But yeah, at certain times there would be extended shutdowns, and then it was either mass avoidance or let's throw him into the deep end and make him swim, you know. But then I always say, now a drowning person can't learn to swim, that you need to have skills before you enter into it, otherwise you are going to get traumatized. So my first real attachment, unfortunately, it's nice to have it as your family, was actually my family dog. That was my portal of opening up my social skills. So I would sit out the backyard and after school, cry, pat my dog, and tell my dog about everything that happened. I didn't have friends. I would just sit under a tree at school. It just wasn't a pleasant experience for me. I didn't like it. I just didn't want to be involved in it. It was all too overwhelming. At 9 years old, that dog died, a very violent death. It had a fit. It was thrashing its head on the concrete type of scenario. And I, at 9 years old, was holding it down for 45 minutes while my mom was inside. She's on the phone to the vet, she's on the phone to other people, this kind of thing. So my first attachment, then the violent abandonment of that attachment, I had a response which was then to my family seen as excessive. And so it was just go to your room and cry it out or whatever. And we now know that is the worst thing you can possibly do. You need to maintain that connection, let them know their emotions are valid, return them to safety. Otherwise, you were destined to this PTSD. I'd completely forgot about that. I knew I had a dog. I knew that she was important in my life when I was young. I had another dog that came in after that, that more or less replaced it for that time, same breed. And that then I transferred all of my kind of emotions onto that dog and treated it the same way. It wasn't until about 2.5 years ago that after doing, or maybe 2 years ago, after doing, gosh, maybe that was halfway through the amount of therapy sessions that I've done. So I'd started working through some things, I'd started having some tools, I'd had some success there. And in my personal life, in my personal pillars, there was some safety that was popping up, both professionally, my home. I always say that we have three we have to look after. You have to feel safe. So often that is the home. You have to feel validated and you have to have that social connection. And all three were coming to the light after having severe disconnect of jumping from house to house, traveling around the world, trying to find who I was, to not having a home. Work was not working out and disconnecting from the family, so, and friends. So finally that was coming in. I was doing a yoga session and I had a full-on re-experience of my dog's death at 9 years old. It flashed back and I'm sitting there weeping. This is a couple of years ago. And that was the body saying, you're ready to hold this. I'll finish off with, once you then see that, and as an incorrect roadmap with grief, you can then understand, and this is where your original question of how can we know why loss was so difficult for me, even to trivial extent, and I shared this on a post recently, where I found it extremely difficult to say goodbye to people, even people that I'd met for a day. Let's say I'm backpacking. Madness. Spend a day with them on a tour, and then I'm either avoiding it, going to the bathroom to avoid the goodbyes,
The
or
goodbye.
trying to hold on. Give me the symbol. What's your phone number? What's your email? I want to make sure that this is not the end. All of that is triggering projection from my incapability of dealing with loss then. And obviously there's all the middle rungs before that and big rungs of not being able to deal with grief and loss as it comes up after that. But that roadmap at 9 years old of your emotions are not valid. If you would like to be part of the family, this is what is being narrated to the nervous system. It's not the direct words that my parents told me, but it's the narration around the behavior. That then dictates for those 20 odd years afterwards how you engage with even the most microscopic version of loss. And then naturally, when I had my mate pass away at 25, I dealt with that terribly because, once again, no roadmap at 9 years old. So I'd say not only highlights how it's important to get over it as a sense of empowerment, but shows you how hostage you are kept by these prior events if you just refuse to open that door.
It's interesting. I mean, I am the exact same way. I am terrible with goodbyes. I'll hold on, hold on, hold on. And I didn't necessarily I didn't experience loss like that, but it makes me think at that young of an age. Later in my life, I absolutely did, but it's making me think like what other instances, what other events may have occurred that may have triggered those same kinds of emotions and made me feel a sense of loss and longing. And,
I can give you another one of where the clinginess comes from as well, if that is part of your experience, because it's definitely part of my experience. Conditional love is a big one. So if
Oh my
you had
God.
to regulate the emotional experience of those close to you, they couldn't handle their emotions, you get used to working for your love and your attachment, right? So then that becomes a very tiring experience. And you project that into the world most often as people pleasing, that it's an inability to say no to people because you're used to saying yes to maintain the connection. Because I am still working off this. I call myself a recovering people pleaser. But by
Love this.
doing that, the relationship experience is highly energetic and tiring. So we become clingy. So then you get the little projections there of, I don't want to say goodbye because, God, I met a nice person. This is usually such a high boundary for me. I don't want to do that again over and over again. So we hold on to toxic relationships, be it in our love life, in our close family interactions, in our close friends, and so forth. These are, again, these trigger and projection moments that tend to get replicated across the attachment styles. I try to say P as many times as I can to remember it, and I have it written on my whiteboard over here. Your parents goes to your peers, goes to your partner, goes to your superiors, and lastly, you arrive at yourself, and all of a sudden, you have this relationship of I have to work to feel okay. There's no rest without exhaustion, right? The only way you can go to sleep at night is to say, look at all the stuff that I did today, when we should feel amazingness no matter what. You are okay as who you are right here, right now.
Right
That's the
now,
normal human experience. That's what we deserve, you know?
not in this world. I feel like in this hustle culture, the world that we live in today, it's like go, 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 go. And honestly, more and more living in New York, I feel it. I feel it. I'm like, oh my God, like I have to suffocate in order to just, I don't know. It's weird. And it's weird to think about because then I think about, I think about these other places. I think about India, which is where we're from. And that's not the overall sentiment. Like, that's not the pace of life elsewhere. And that's not the pace of life pre-social media, which is also interesting to think about.
Yeah, definitely. Again, I like alliteration because it helps me remember things. I like to say hijacking hypervigilance. We are creating these baselines for the different categories in our life, that the only way we can meet those is if we are in that activated state. So I say to myself, gosh, I need to complete this by this time. And the only way of making that happen is absolutely smashing yourself. And yes, when you're 21, you have the energy to do that. When you burn out three times by more or less 3 decades of
Over
your
the course
life,
of your
then
life.
it's not the greatest
It's not.
equation. And I also throw in there, when I'm operating from that state, I call it the hypervigilant narrator, that the person in my mind at that time, I believe wholeheartedly in their decisions. They're weighing up all of the things in the world. Yes, that, this is a worthy goal. There's a very different dude that speaks when I touch that calm and stay in that calm place. And when I stick to my routines to make sure that I'm working off that stress and I can sit in that, I use the words of a mentor in the meditation space that I utilize, that awareness sits in stillness. That is where all your problems are solved. And by utilizing that, I find personally I'm actually more productive because I can go and do yoga and then I'll write 10 pages of notes because my subconscious was working on it, but I wasn't giving it the appropriate time to come up to the surface. And it's the same why we have shower thoughts, right? For the first time in your day, you're deprived of stimuli and you're staring there at the wall and you're like, that's what I should do. That's stillness. You're
That's
there.
still that's yes. Oh my gosh.
It's
Yes. Oh, I think about that
crazy.
all the time. I'm like, sometimes I crave it. I just need to do nothing. I just need to sit here and look at the wall and just do nothing. I'm like, please.
Yeah, that's it. It's a form of meditation. It genuinely is.
It is. Going back a little bit to this whole concept of clinginess and emotional attachments and whatnot, I want to look a little bit at the other side of things. So we're talking about where, the clinginess can come from, but what about for those who feel very avoidant or like laissez-faire, like they're just kind of hands off? What about that? Where could that come from?
Sure. My latest, so I the pro the way that I'm working towards the book and the way that it's I've actually been able to speak to publishers, thankfully, is we spoke of sort of off air prior to coming on here and building in public, is having a newsletter and also having a podcast. So then if people like to read or if they like to listen to the podcast, they can do both. And I just wrote the most recent episode of the Dark Side of Sunny Syndrome. And I talk about this because I have members in my close inner circle and caregivers that try to live on the sunny side of life. And that is highly avoidant. It is saying that the sun is peaking, if we keep going with the metaphor, the sun is looking onto that sunny side of the road, and you're denying that the shade exists. But the sun goes down every day, doesn't it? And you keep averting your eyes. No, I can keep it true, you know? I'll avoid this confrontation. And then finally, the sun goes down. You're sitting in darkness. And then, as you touched upon, victim mindset. Why? If we don't access all of the especially negative emotions in our body that are there to save us, only bad things are going to happen. So I think that this avoidance, which you're talking about relationship styles, but I think it is a style of interacting with everything in our life. If we
Interesting.
avoid what is friction, it teaches the nervous system that we were incapable of overcoming that. And in this last post, I was sharing that with a couple of experiences there. And I told you that socializing was very sensitive for me. My first birthday party that I was invited to when I was 6 years old with my first friend was extremely overwhelming for me, that I was showing all these signs of sort of childhood panic attacks, that my mom said, all or nothing, no, let's call in sick. I don't want to have to go through this, you know, validate the emotions and maybe put a toe in the water. We go for 10 minutes, see what's going on, blah, 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 blah. It was no. What happens then? Very crucial time, roadmap. This event was too big for you. So your nervous system tries to allocate, okay, where's the threat? Let's bring in more stimuli that we need to filter. Let's spend more energy on filtering that. And let's ramp up that cortisol next time because we weren't prepared. So we're going to give you an energy boost. So anything that we avoid, be it a phone call, which I'm big at avoiding, an email, which I'm big at avoiding, It seeds in your mind this incapability, the disempowerment. And so I think that we need to
Wow.
remember there is a cost to not attacking what comes to us. Each one of those moments is a moment where we have the opportunity. It is binary. Is this going to be empowering or disempowering? You don't get to have a middle ground.
Yeah. So interesting to think about, like even something as tiny as a phone call or an email. It's that's it's just you avoiding it is a manifestation of your past experiences and your past trauma, essentially.
100%. It's the trigger moment. If you feel incapable, and for me, as I said, as a recovering people pleaser and as a person that these burnouts were characterized by sheer disconnect. So it was one really bad one was like airplane mode for sort of 6 weeks. I couldn't work. I was having massive panic attacks, all these kind of things that was really disruptive to being able to look after yourself. These moments where, yeah, you get triggered on an email or a phone call and all these kind of things, that is the behavior of attacking things. That if your whole life has been avoiding and something comes up and you say, I need to keep myself safe, I go and avoid, the nervous system just repeatedly says, don't worry, we've got your back. Here's more cortisol. And so we know that if you put something off, it stays in your brain. And
Yeah.
you might dream about it and all that kind of thing. Whereas if you just rip the band-aid, you say to yourself, I'm capable. That challenge that came to me, I overcame it and it's no longer a big deal. But it can be the silliest things, the very silliest things.
So in a lot of these cases, it's better to rip the band-aid off, right? Is that what I'm hearing?
I believe so, and you can reverse that. So I talk about this, and hopefully you've never had to experience this, and I hope that anyone listening hasn't had to, but if you reach this sheer disconnect, then I believe you have to basically reverse that and pick out the smallest trigger moments and demonstrate capability within that. So for me, when that was that real bad social anxiety where I was scared of even going out the door, it is okay. Forget about the people that mean a lot to you that you're scared of interacting with. Forget about these important consequential relationships of how you show up. Go outside and try to get a smile from a stranger. Okay, I'm in Berlin at the time. Go to a tourism area and say to the person, hey, did you want me to take a photo of you? You know, there's a family standing there trying to take a selfie. And they, oh, sure, thank you so much. Like, so great you were coincidentally walking past and I'm just doing loops, like seeing the right family that look kind. And then, okay, take the photo. Thank you so much. Have a great day. Boom. There is
Yeah.
my first moment of social engagement that makes me feel good. Now I know more of the science behind it. We need a certain amount of eye contact per day to confirm that we are part of the tribe. Text messages and emails do not calm the nervous system. It does nothing to oxytocin, does nothing in terms of negating cortisol. Voice does, touch does. Another small example that I can say, if there are people struggling out there like I was, massage. If you have the money and you're in a really bad environment and you're feeling terrible, that touch does wonders, absolute wonders. It confirms you are part of the tribe and also massages the hell out of the vagus nerve, which finally gives you the opportunity to say, oh, I am in
Huh.
rest, as opposed to that hypervigilance that is trying to
Fight or
protect you because
flight.
it thinks there's a lion coming to eat you.
Wow. Look at that. That is very interesting. And I always wonder, I was like, oh, massage. Like, why do I need a massage? Yeah, it's just you're never told why. You're never told the science behind it. You're never told the reason that you should
100%.
actually do it. You're just told to do X, not why.
Let me give you an example on the autism side of things,
Yeah.
and why it's activation and reactivity as opposed to when. People are thinking, well, the kid won't interact. We need to pump him up with something. They discovered is the D1 dopamine receptor, which is an activatory receptor rather than an inhibitory one. So it ramps you up. And to combat that is what's the name? It's like adenosine or something like that.
Adenosine.
It pumps it down. Yeah, I mean, it pulls it down. That massage is adenosine focused as opposed to dopamine focus. So if you are, for example, on the spectrum and you are pumped up, overstimulized, hyperreactive, massage is an activity that counters that. But nobody talks about this. They're like,
Nobody
get them
talks about
on the
that. Just get them.
drugs. Yeah, get them on the drugs. And the
Yeah.
vagus nerve, and the third one that I want to mention in regards to massage is the lymphatic drainage.
Yes.
The
Oh,
that
yeah.
doesn't go. It just sits there unless you move. So unless you're doing yoga or inversions and twists, which most people aren't, massage, going down the vagus nerve. You can just do it yourself at home. It
Yeah.
releases the buildup of those toxins as well. Massive. And we don't hear this in school, do we? Tell it to 7-year-old kids.
I know. Little trick for those who are listening. I do it every night and I just do it in the shower. Like I'll just massage my neck and I'll massage it downwards so that it drains automatically. You know, you don't have to go spend like a bajillion bucks on a massage, but you can do it at home intermittently. You know, it takes 5 minutes. It takes 5 minutes, but it makes a difference. It does.
Yeah, legs up on the walls, another free one.
Yep.
Doing
Yep.
the twists on the floor, or just simply doing some inversions as well in yoga, free.
Yeah.
You can do
Yeah.
it at the bus
Free.
stop.
Yep. Yes, you can. I do. I'll fill up my water bottle and just be doing my thing.
Good on you.
We touched on it, but we didn't dive into more your journey with burnout and how that kind of really happened. One burning question that I didn't have was if when you look back at that time now or the build up, the lead up to it, are there any things that you noticed that you would go back and tell yourself, hey, don't do this, don't engage in this, do this differently. Essentially, if you could go back and talk to yourself pre all of this, what would you say to him?
Yeah, good question. You have to just ask yourself why you're doing it. And that's why therapy is so important, because I inherited the roadmap of overwork, which I've discovered is part of this father gap that goes back multiple generations. So I asked my grandfather about his father, and he still to this day tries to avoid the conversation, and
Yeah.
he's a strong old type, you know, like he's still alive, thankfully, on
Wow.
that side of the
It's amazing.
family. And you can tell how fragile he is talking about it. His father left at a very young age, just walked out the door, didn't have a conversation, just didn't come back. His way of dealing with that was, I have to be the man of the household. And so you come from that scarcity mindset. And even when he was able to then stand up for his family, and because all of my family sort of from a working class background, okay, we've got the house, you know, we've got food on the table. It was then still excessively work, because that's your voice with the world. And then to calm down, take a drink of the bottle, right? My dad thankfully didn't hit the bottle, which is great. I think it's because of what he saw in the household of my grandfather. But he still took the inherited roadmap of overwork, not being able to set a boundary there. That's your sense of validation. That's your relic of love to the family. Look what I'm bringing you, you know? When we know these days, presence over presence is what I keep saying. Your physical presence as opposed to relics of your love, you know? But then how do I engage with this man that I desperately want approval with? If I'm the little duck trying to imprint upon him, I'll speak his language. Where does he go? Work, 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 work. I hardly saw the guy for 25 years of my life. Work. So from a very young age, I desperately wanted to work. I remember at 11 years old, like begging my parents, please let me get a job. Because now I know the science behind it, especially with the father's side. And I released this video on social media yesterday of the study that I came across. If there is a emotional unavailability of the father, the closer the cortisol levels sync up with the kids. So they can predict based on the cortisol levels of the father what the kids' cortisol levels will be more accurately when there's a disconnect there, because the nervous system says, we're not working it out via verbal. We're not working out by body language and presence. So every time we engage, we're going to work out what our safety level is. Holy crap, it's not good, because this guy's stressed out. We get the cortisol action hormone. Why does an 11-year-old kid want to work? Because it wants to go out and help in the family. There's this inner drive there. And so the burnout cycle for me was founded upon this language that I'd inherited with the world, that if you want to be seen, if you want to be approved of, if you want to be a man in this world, you work your butt off. So if I was to go back, I would say, why? Why are you doing this? And do you need to do this? Are you able to find nourishing social connections, be it within the family or your close circle, without doing presence rather than performance? And that's rewriting scripts that have that run very, very deep. And from so my first burnout was because I was working in a I worked in a private bank in Australia, and that was like 7 days a week work, burnt out. I then tried an entrepreneurial project, which didn't work naturally since I was operating from a hypervigilant mindset of burnout that wasn't healed. And yeah, as I mentioned before, the loss of my friend and these type of things, that didn't work. Then I went into the modeling world and that worked, but I wasn't able to sustain it because I was using the roadmap from the bank and from this entrepreneurial where there was no boundaries, that all of a sudden I'm in there and I'm saying more, 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 never
Wow.
say no, you know, this is the way to go. This is how you speak with the world. And it wasn't until I worked out it was a script and I was destined to repeat. And Carl Jung says this, what is not brought to consciousness comes to us as fate. That was never brought to consciousness. What is the connection roadmap? You know, that's crazy.
Yeah. Wow. That's very interesting. It's fascinating to think about. Also, that quote is very powerful. That's very powerful. What's
Huge,
not brought
huge.
to the
First time I heard
consciousness
it,
is. Yeah,
I stopped. I was
that's
like, tell me again.
insane.
What did you say? I was
That's
doing it
really,
in a therapy session.
yeah.
I was like, hang on, stop.
That's big. That's big. What is not brought to consciousness is brought to us by fate.
Comes to us as fate.
Comes to
And this
us
is
as
this
fate.
trigger and
Wow.
projection. If you don't understand the motives that are under there, because the emotions drive our thoughts. We buy on emotion, justify on logic. This is what all the marketing does to us in the world, right?
Yes,
That's the
yes.
same with our individual choices. We buy our choices, be it a purchase or just a person that we're engaging with, based upon the emotional experience. So then what do we do? As a male that's straight, you are going to find a female that replicates your mum. You are going to find that attachment style. And the same with the girls replicating their
Girls,
dads, all those kind of things. And if you don't bring that up, you're just doomed to repeat, repeat, repeat all of the things that went through your family's history. And I mean, this is the book that I love, the It Didn't Start With You by Mark Vaughan. Or Wall, I don't know if that's pronounced with a V. I've got too much German going in my mind. These genetic expressions that are desperately seeking closure, and each generation that gets it gets another attempt, but we're too busy. And so we just repeat, repeat, repeat.
That's the thing. That's what they say. Your external reality is a manifestation of your internal world, or your external world is a
Sure.
manifestation of your internal reality.
Mirrored unto us. Yeah,
Yes,
absolutely.
yes, yes. Jason, is there anything else that you'd like to say? Is there anything that you feel like our audience, I feel like we didn't like we touched on so much in such a short amount of time. And I think we could sit here all day talking about something or another. I think you have to come on and do a round two.
Absolutely. Happy to do
Yeah.
so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think that everyone needs to take that time. If I could advocate everyone have a therapist, and I know that it is not cheap, but we spend a lot of money on our coping mechanisms. So I have substituted alcohol for a therapist in terms of what goes out on the budget.
Well,
But it
what's
is
healthier?
so
Yeah.
important. What's that?
Yeah, I said, I mean, it's healthier. It's the healthier coping mechanism.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the
Yeah.
reason why I think we all need it is because how much the world has changed. We don't have that spontaneous interactions with the world anymore. We've lost
No,
the village.
no.
And so if I talk about the times that I spend in a lot of t I've been in Bali a lot of times, and a lot of the times I stay in these traditional villages as opposed to like the tourist meccas and stay in the homestays, and you see how we once interacted, and you've got
Yeah.
multi-generations and cross-generations. What happens is you receive both skill set and capacity based on what's available in terms of receiving that. So when somebody doesn't have the capacity or the skill set, they refer to somebody else, where it's almost the opposite of what we got at the moment, where there's nobody else around. We've got this concentrated caregiving in an inner circle, and everyone is only showing up from this scarcity. So we're just inheriting hypervigilance, hypervigilance. So if you don't have grandpa walking around with all the time in the world to steer you straight, the necessity for a therapist. We have commoditized and externalized a lot of our lives, and I feel like that guidance has occurred, and we don't realize just how much we need that those conversations, those
Those
deep conversations,
conversations. Yeah.
past superficial chats in the cafe. Hey, how you going?
Absolutely.
Okay, sounds great. All
How
right,
are
move
you? What are
on.
you doing this
How are you
weekend?
feeling? That's
Yeah.
the question.
Yeah. How are
Really?
you truly doing? That's the first thing I ask my friends. And for a
Right.
second, it's like, oh, you're just asking that small talk. And then I ask them every day. And then they're like, oh, you actually want to know how I am. It's
Let
important.
me
It's
give you a
important to talk
follow-up.
about.
How are you feeling? And then how are you feeling about how are you feeling? Because that's an important one again of how you're getting through things. Because if you have shame about your feeling, that's something that's not going on there. That's not
Question.
integrated within your experience. And that social interaction is a great way of alleviating any of that shame, just that presence there. Actually, you know what? I'm a bit embarrassed about the way that I'm acting. The other person there going, totally understandable. Like, that's fine. There's a lot going on there. Social connection is proved, and that person's baggage is kind of put down for the day. It's those next level questions is where we're missing the conversations in our daily life from. Lonely crowded this. It's crazy.
And that spontaneity is another thing that is just so
True.
important that we're just so lacking. And I find that is so apparent to me when I experience that spontaneity. I'm like, wow, so much good just came out of something that I hadn't planned. You can't plan everything good. It's something I know, like, it in this society, it's like, oh, it's ingrained in us from childhood. Like, what are you gonna do with your life? What's your life plan? Right? But that manifests on a daily basis, because it's like, what should my plan be for the entire day? And I think there's also a sense of pressure that at least I feel in terms of, oh, I need to know that I'm doing X, Y, Z today. But sometimes it's okay not to know. Sometimes it's okay to let the day just take you where it's going to take you, because oftentimes I feel like that's where the beauty comes from.
And that's where you get your solutions from the cross-pollination as well. I talk about the loss of the third place. This will be in the book too, where we have home, we have work, and now with a lot of work from home, that's actually closed off. But the third place, where is that? In England, traditionally that was the pub, and bad weather, you go to the pub and there's still a lot of culture around that where a lot of people have their dinners in the pub and all that kind of thing. It doesn't necessarily mean you're getting blind drunk. It's just another place. For me growing up, I realized my third place was surfing. And then, as everyone was getting busy and all that kind of thing, you start losing it. As soon as I came back to Australia this time, I'm like, okay, what's my third place? And I'm super into the sauna and the cold plunges. Everyone is, and it's phenomenal. I go down there and, okay, busy, busy, busy. Take the 30 minutes, go down there, and these non-performance, non-consequential conversations come about. And you walk out going, oh, the questions that I had, they're solved because I just aired the dirty laundry with a random stranger in the sauna. And not to worry you, in Australia, we have to wear our bathing suits. It's not like Europe where you're just naked having all the conversations. They're like, yeah, I've got this idea. And everyone's.
Like, oh,
It's not
there's an
something like that
extra,
here in Australia. There's a lot of
extra,
conversation.
there's extra layer of vulnerability as well.
Absolutely.
Well, Jason, why don't you go ahead and shout out anything and everything that you'd like to shout out? Of course, your newsletter, your podcast, your socials will all be linked in the show notes. But if there's anything else, take the mic away. It's yours.
Yeah, so the epicenter of everything is Instagram. So you can find me on Instagram, Jason Field. And then from there, you can generally find me in all the other places as well. I'm trying to build up a little bit more of a presence on YouTube and the longer form there and all that kind of thing. But yeah, whatever anyone likes to. Sorry, I just got distracted. A big cockatoo landed on the fence. If people like reading, I wrote 8,000 words in the last newsletter as I'm trying to build up this book. If people like listening, it's almost a 2-hour podcast on Spotify and whatnot. So hopefully I've got all bases covered in terms of everyone's consumption preferences.
You definitely do. You have everything there. Okay, I'm gonna thank you so much for coming. This was a lovely conversation. Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for listening to another episode of What's On Your Mind. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. I hope you guys are all doing well in the midst of finals. This is definitely a must listen to, so I hope it was helpful. I hope you guys learned something new. Happy holidays. I hope you all are doing well, and I will see you all next week for another episode, most likely the last episode of the year. Happy holidays, folks. Bye.